This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Evolution of the World and of Humanity, given in 1923. This is Lecture 10. If we wish to bring before our souls the nature of the experience between death and rebirth, we must, above all, be clear as to the enormous difference between our experience here in earth life and what we go through between death and a new birth. Here in earth life we perform our actions in such a way that having accomplished something, it detaches itself from us and ceases to belong to us, so to speak. We manufacture many things which then detach themselves from us. Indeed, most people detach these things from themselves in external social life by selling them. All that is accomplished by man in his earth life, as the result of his will, so passes over into earth existence that man feels himself comparatively but little connected with it. I expressly say comparatively little. And the thoughts through which man created that existence, or which he creates in that existence, withdraw into his inner being. They either remain as merely passive thoughts, or become memories, habits, modes of life, and so on. All this is different in the life between death and a new birth. There, whatever a man accomplishes returns to him again, in a certain sense. Now we must remember that here on earth we exercise our impulses of will on the things belonging to the kingdoms of nature, on the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms. We form them, we set them in movement. And we also set our fellow men in movement, insofar as their human side is concerned. In the spiritual world, between death and a new birth, we are among purely spiritual beings, in part among beings whose whole existence is spent in the spiritual world, whom we may call divine spiritual beings, and who never embody themselves in earthly substances. To these belong the higher beings of the hierarchies, the anguloi beings, the exousiae beings, the seraphim and cherubim beings. Other names might also be chosen for them, for we cannot be hindered by terminology. But these are ancient and honored names, and we may well apply them to the beings we now discover anew in the spiritual regions. Between death and rebirth, man lives partly among such beings, and partly among disembodied human souls now endowed with spiritual bodies. Those among whom he lived while on earth, or those awaiting their earth life, who are shortly to descend again to earth. Certainly our life with them is to some extent dependent on whether we are karmically connected with these particular human souls, or whether we formed links with them here in earth life. Those with whom we were less in connection while on earth have less to do with us in the spiritual world, and so on. More will be said about this later. Man also comes into touch with beings who are never actually embodied as man himself in his earth life, for they are of a lower grade than he, and never attain human form. These are the beings belonging to the different kingdoms of nature, elemental beings living in the plant kingdom, in the stone or mineral kingdom, and also in the animal kingdom. Thus man, between death and a new birth, becomes united with all the inhabitants of the spiritual world. I must also state that these beings manifest themselves to the initiated, intuitive, and actively imaginative consciousness. It is by means of this consciousness that we can look into the world in which man lives between death and a new birth. When a man lives this different kind of life, his whole human disposition and his whole human attitude become different too. For instance, to return once more to this important theme, when we on earth make a machine, everything we do with our hands, in the process of putting together the various parts, flows from our will and our thoughts. But in the spiritual world, between death and a new birth, where we continually behave as souls and are active as such, whenever we do anything, there radiates from all that we do something which we recognize as thoughts, which live in the light, in the radiance. Whereas, here on earth, our thoughts stay with us. In that world they do not remain with man, but shine forth from all that he does. They radiate as a luminous essence from his every action. In the spiritual world we can never do the simplest thing without a thought springing forth from it. That thought is not like an earthly human thought, which, though it may really be an unwholesome one, can yet be concealed in the inner being of a man, for it is individual to man, perhaps indeed a quite personal human thought. The thought that springs up in life between death and rebirth is a cosmic thought. It expresses what the cosmos, and thus essentially what the beings of the whole spiritual and cosmic world, have to say concerning what we do. I want you to picture the following very distinctly. Man is active in his life between death and a new birth. By reason of his activity, everything affecting the soul, every action of the soul, every turn of the soul, I might say immediately becomes cosmic thought. Thus, when we do anything, we imprint it into the spiritual world, and from every direction comes the reply of the cosmos. What the cosmos says shines forth from all we do. The cosmos pronounces final judgment upon it. That, however, is not all. For in the radiance of the cosmic world of thought, something else glimmers. Other thoughts glimmer therein, and we cannot say that these have their origin in the cosmos. Thus we find the thoughts, which shine as clear flames in the cosmos, though not in earthly life, permeated by all sorts of dark thoughts, which glimmer in everything. Now, whereas these clear, radiant thoughts originating in the cosmos fill us, in the life between death and rebirth, with a deep feeling of well-being, these glimmering thoughts are frequently, not always, but very frequently, extremely disturbing, for they are the after-effects of our own earth life. Thus, if in our earth life we have formed good thoughts about a thing, these good thoughts glimmer out of the shining cosmic images after death. If we formed evil thoughts, these glimmer out of the radiant thoughts comprising the cosmic judgment, and come to meet us, so to speak. Thus, when we see what the cosmos says to us, we see at the same time what we ourselves have put there. Now that world is not one which detaches itself from man. It remains inwardly connected with him. After death, man carries his cosmic existence within him. He also bears within him a memory of his earth life, the life just completed. His first task is to efface that, to get accustomed to do without it, so that he may really become a cosmic being. As long as we are in that region of spiritual life, designated in my book Theosophy as the soul life, we are principally engaged with these glimmering thoughts, caused by our earth thoughts, earth habits, and the cleverness belonging to earth. Through the influence of these, what might otherwise, as we realize, be beautiful cosmic images, become mere caricatures. So during our passage through the soul life, we wander uncomfortably through the cosmos under the guidance of these caricatures of cosmic images, until we become free from all that still binds us to earth and can find the bridge leading to what in the book Theosophy I have called the Spirit Land. We then leave behind us the disposition of soul we acquired on earth, and are able to act purely according to the instructions of the spiritual beings into whose realm we enter, and to behave in the only way possible there. You see, man does not take with him into the world in which he dwells after death what lives in his physical and etheric bodies. That is thrown away and dissolves into the cosmos. He only takes with him what he, as ego and astral body, experienced in those bodies. From this, however, something exceptionally significant and important can be learned. While a man goes about on earth, he calls his physical body and his etheric body, of which he does not know much, excepting that inasmuch as he lives in the forces of growth and so on, he does at any rate feel it. These bodies he calls his own. Now man has no right to call these his body, for the only part that is his is that which is present in the ego and astral body. That which lives in the physical and etheric body is, even while man lives on earth, the property of divine spiritual beings. While he lives on earth, the divine spiritual beings live and weave within it. They continue to work within it, even during man's sleep, when he himself is not present. Man would indeed be in a very evil case if he had to care for his physical and etheric bodies himself, in a permanently waking state between birth and death. He is obliged continually to give them into the charge of the gods. This is more particularly the case in childhood, where the sleep of childhood is by far the most important. Later in life, sleep still works correctively, but the really fructifying sleep belongs to the first years of childhood. In olden times of man's evolution, this fact was recognized, for the human body was then called a temple of the gods. Men then felt the wonderful structure of the human body to be the temple of gods, and in all their architectural works they imitated the laws of the physical and etheric bodies. This can best be observed in the architecture of the East, but we can also find it in that of the Egyptian and Greek. In the way in which the cherubim are placed in the temples of the East, in the position of the sphinxes and columns, we have a lifelike presentment of what was felt to be the working of the gods in the human physical and etheric bodies. But in the course of man's further development, he lost consciousness of this. Without having any inkling of it, he quite incorrectly calls his physical body his own body, whereas in all its earthly activities, it is really the property of the gods. So that when man today speaks of my body, when he designates that which in a normal state goes on in his body as his own property, it shows the extraordinary arrogance of man of the present civilization. An arrogance of which, of course, he is not the least aware. It is subconscious, but very great. This arrogance is also a sign of how, in ordinary life, that which would otherwise be considered simply in a naturalistic sense is now in our modern age intermixed with moral ingredients. Human language now contains the means of expressing that a man's body is his own property, for men say, my body, thus arrogating to themselves the property of the gods, having embodied arrogance even into their language. Spiritual science must draw attention to these things. It must point out that the moral element is even encroaching on the ordinary naturalistic life, and indeed, as we have seen in this particular case, not a good but an evil moral element. These things show that even our whole life of feeling can be so far altered by a right spiritual knowledge that even our modes of expression will, when we really understand spiritual science, be different from what they are today under the influence of a purely materialistic, naturalistic mode of thought. In order to understand the further experience between death and rebirth, we must call to mind what was said in yesterday's lecture, that when man expands in the spiritual world, the physical aspect of the stars disappears, and he lives in the spiritual counterpart of that which shines down to us and is physically apparent in the radiance of the stars. Just as the earth is the dwelling place of man, who, as a spiritual being, with his ego and astral body, is an inhabitant of earth, so each star is the dwelling place of certain spiritual beings. Man, during his physical life, is connected with the elemental beings of the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms, and also through his external bodily nature with other human souls. In the life between death and a new birth, he comes into connection with the inhabitants of other stars. Life between death and a new birth is actually spent in passing through the stellar world, in companionship with the other divine spiritual beings of the stellar world. As we have seen, the life we lead in the soul world follows immediately on the conclusion of our earth life. It consists essentially of a transposed, retrospective living of all that man experienced unconsciously, pictorially, during the nights of his earth life. A third part of his pastorate life he now spends in disaccustoming himself from bringing what I have called these glimmering thoughts into the cosmic thoughts. Thus a man who dies at about the age of 60 lives 20 years in the soul world. He spends that time in eradicating everything which connects him with physical earth life. When, after his death, he comes into relation with the world of the stars, he has an inner experience. This is of such a nature that he inwardly feels, during the time he spends in the soul world, which is one-third of his earth life, that in this earth life he was very specially connected with the moon existence. Thus, when, as I told you yesterday, man in a sense describes a circle, one half of which extends from birth to death, then returns more quickly, for he does it in a third of the time, he has a feeling that the circle goes round the moon existence, that it follows the spirits of moon existence. I mentioned yesterday that man is not conscious that he returns to his birth. This is not really a circle, but a spiral. Man goes further forward in each evolution, and I really ought to draw the diagram as a spiral. The Mercury beings bring it about that we do not simply travel round the moon in a cycle, but advance further and draw near another existence directly after death. The force of progression of these Mercury beings is partly responsible for this. These beings are rather stronger than the Venus beings, and life is carried forward by them, and banked up and driven back on itself, and in a sense rendered fuller by the Venus beings. Thus man's journey through the soul world runs a course in which he feels himself absorbed into the activity of Moon, Mercury, and Venus. We must now form a clear picture of this existence. Here on earth we say, I, as human being, have a head, that is principally set in motion by what one might call the brain center, the pineal gland and the like. This is the principal organ in the center of the head. I, as man, have in the middle of my body the heart. I, as man, have in the mobile organism of the metabolic system that which belongs to the whole of the kidney system. Now in the soul world, after death, one cannot say, I, as man, consist of head, chest with heart, and limbs with metabolic system. There would be no sense in that. After death, we say, I, as man, consist of what comes from the spirits of the moon. This saying corresponds to what we say on earth, I have a head. But after death, in the soul world, we must say, I have that which comes to me from the spirits of the moon. Here on earth, we say, I have a heart within my breast, which is the expression of all my respiratory and circulatory system. Again, this kind of speech only has a meaning on earth, for of course the heart is abandoned. After death, we must say, I bear within me the forces of Venus, that after death is the correspondence. And whereas, here on earth, we say, I have a limb and metabolic system, with all the organs pertaining thereto, particularly the kidneys, after death, we must correspondingly say, in me live the forces coming from the Mercury beings. Here on earth, we say, I, as man, consist of head, breast, abdomen, and limbs. After death, we say, I, as man, am moon, Venus, and Mercury. This represents absolutely the real inner existence of life. For here on earth, our existence as physical human beings depends upon the cooperative working of our head, heart, and digestive system. Everything depends on this. In the slightest movement of our hands, there is activity proceeding from head, heart, and digestive system, which are continually transmuting the substances brought into play when we move our hands. Our whole earth existence runs its course in our head, heart, and limbs, speaking, of course, in a very limited sense. So also does our whole existence run its course in the soul world, in the moon, Mercury, and Venus forces, which are then within us. Just as we are head, heart, and limbs on earth, so are we moon, Mercury, and Venus in the soul world. And we are thereby, in a certain sense, actually transported into an age in which man, in his natural existence, lived in very much more ancient epochs than our own. I have several times referred to those more ancient epochs of man's evolution in the course of these lectures. Man had then a sort of instinctive vision, and I have referred to the types of men still remaining as a survival of these. At times, even while still on Earth, man had an inkling of his extra-earthly connection with Moon, Mercury, and Venus. As far as Earth life is now concerned, this consciousness is lost to the man of the present day. What is the reason that it has been lost? When we speak of these things, which in all their deep significance really lie concealed behind the veil of the physical world, and which can only be spoken of as coming from the region beyond the threshold, strong opposition is of course aroused. Or perhaps it may be more polite to say the criticism of the day is aroused. Indeed, it is particularly difficult today to speak of that which is initiation truth. We must either speak in so abstract a manner that the man of today does not notice what is meant, we must either clothe our meaning in abstract ideas, or express it in words really characteristic of the things in question. Many people become simply furious when they hear this. This is easy to understand, because they are told of a world they really fear and hate, and of which they wish to get rid. This must not, however, deter us from again beginning to speak of these things in the civilized world in a true and loyal way. Therefore, if one were attentively to consider, though it would not help matters much, those who hate the science of initiation, we should have to put the case as follows. Man, when he makes his way into the soul world, enters a state which somewhat resembles a former condition of the earth, when he still possessed an instinctive spiritual truth. And in this original, instinctive spiritual truth lived the moon forces. Putting the matter thus, we might perhaps meet the materialistic ideas of the present day halfway, but that would be putting it in far too abstract a form. If we do not shrink from the unavoidable criticism of the materialistic thinkers, we must speak in a different way. We must say, in a now far distant epoch, this will be gone into more closely in the lectures yet to be given, a very ancient prehistoric epoch, when man pursued his evolution on the earth, he was in the company of spiritual beings, who were not themselves directly connected with the earth, but who in their earth life were also connected with the cosmos. We may say that these were divine teachers. The mysteries were then presided over by super-earthly teachers, who instructed the earth men. In the most remote ages, these teachers did not put on a solid, dense, physical body of flesh, but worked upon human beings in etheric bodies. Thus these, who were the very earliest teachers of mankind in the mysteries, the chief teachers, of whom the physically incarnated human beings were only the servants, were etheric, divine teachers. These beings, at a very ancient epoch of man's evolution, were co-citizens of the earth with man. We can therefore say in a very real and true sense that there was once an ancient epoch in the earthly development of the world when men inhabited the world together with divine spiritual beings who were certainly not to be seen walking about, but who manifested themselves to those who were led to them in the right way by those who served in the temples. They only showed themselves in the mysteries, but they could be seen there. And in the mysteries they became inhabitants of the earth, together with human beings. Since that time these beings have withdrawn from the earth to the moon, and now live imperceptible to earth life in a cosmic citadel, as it were, in the inner part of the moon existence. Thus when we contemplate the inner part of the moon existence, we have to visualize it as the assembly of those beings who in their etheric bodies were once upon a time the great teachers of mankind on earth. In reality, we ought never to look up at the moon without reminding ourselves that assembled there are those who once were our teachers here on earth. For what comes down to man on earth from the moon is not what dwells there, but what it radiates from the rest of the cosmos. Just as it reflects the light, so too does it reflect all the cosmic workings. What comes to earth from the moon today is simply what is reflected from the cosmos. When we look up to the moon, we see most clearly the moonlight, but that, of course, is not all, and indeed but the smallest part of what is there. We see a reflection of the cosmic activities, but we do not see that which lives in the inner part of the moon and which once lived on earth. Only in his life in the soul world, immediately after death, does man come again under the influence of those beings who once dwelt on earth. These are they who, with the judgment of the past work correctively, these are they who, with the judgment of the past, work correctively after a man's death on what he has done on earth. So that in our present epoch, man, after death, really is once more in connection with those who, as divine spiritual beings, once instructed or trained all humanity. The moon must be considered spiritually as a cosmic citadel, into which have withdrawn those beings who were once among men, and with whom we again enter into relation directly we begin our journey through the soul world after death. Now, when a man has concluded what, in a sense, belongs to the region of the moon existence, the task is assigned to him in the cosmos of passing over to the sun existence. Thus, whereas the first cycle, or rather the first spiral, is more or less in the center of the moon existence, the circular or spiral movement of man develops further, expands further, and passes on from the region of the moon to that of the sun. Drawing representing space can only be of an illusionary nature, for all the events take place in one dimension, in the supersensible. Yet, as we are obliged to use earthly language, we may say, man, in his life between death and rebirth, after completing the first cycle in the region of the moon, now enters into a similar relation with the spiritual sun as he formerly had with the moon. He must now become a being in whom the life he hitherto led in moon, Venus, Mercury, must be metamorphosed on his entrance into the region of the spiritual sun, which in my book Theosophy I have called the Spirit Land. He must indeed become an entirely different being. In his earth life he says, I am a head being, a heart or chest being, I am a metabolic or limb being. Directly after death he says, I am moon, Mercury, or Venus. Now he can no longer say this, or his existence would be arrested in the spiritual world, between the soul world and the actual spirit life. To prepare for his spirit-soul life, man must now undergo a remarkable metamorphosis. He must become what I will characterize in the following way. The sun must become his skin. The sun must encompass him. Just as we on earth, with respect to our physical body, are clothed in a skin, so must we enter our spirit existence clothed in a skin which is in all parts composed of the spiritual sun forces. It is not very easy to picture this. There the sun is the center and it shines into the environment. When we enter the region of the spiritual sun, it is no longer in one place. It is everywhere, within the whole periphery. It is, in actual fact, the spiritual skin of the human being that we have now become. No longer outside the sun, but in the inner part of the spiritual sun region, we now have that which in our earthly life we describe as head, heart, and limbs, and which directly after death we call moon, Mercury, and Venus, which are then within us. We now are sun, and have these organs within us. They are the inner organs, just as here we have heart, pineal gland, and kidneys. But all these are changed into the spiritual. They have to be gradually formed. When we come to the spirit land from the soul world, they are not at first fully developed. This is to be done by degrees. For this reason, we do not describe a single circle in the sun existence as we did in the moon. We describe three circles. The sun existence is fulfilled in three cycles. In the first cycle, which is really the Mars cycle, the spiritual Mars organ is formed. In the second cycle, which is really the Jupiter cycle, the Jupiter organ is formed. And in the last cycle, the Saturn organ is formed. Three cycles, which, as I shall explain more minutely in tomorrow's lecture, take considerably longer to pass through in relation to earthly time than does that of the moon. The moon cycle is traveled through in comparatively quick time. These sun cycles are traversed, as I will explain more fully tomorrow, about 12 times slower. Thus we travel through a Mars cycle, a Jupiter cycle, and a Saturn cycle. Through the whole time of man's passage, through the region in which he dwells in the world of the spheres, and participates in the spiritual forces of that world, he is continually active. Just as we here are active through the nature forces, so are we active there, through the forces of the so-called higher hierarchies, which only present their most outward physical reflection, their physical manifestation, in the stellar heavens, as the sun and moon appear in their physical aspect. Now, if man is to find the transition from the region of the moon to that of the sun, he must have guidance. I have already indicated what this guidance must be. We have learned that in the very earliest epochs of humanity, beings lived on earth who have now withdrawn and entrenched themselves, as it were, in the cosmic citadel of the moon. These are they with whom man once more enters into relation after death. There are, moreover, descendants of these beings who, during the earlier post-Atlantean epoch of humanity, from time to time appeared on earth. In the East, these beings are called bodhisattvas. Although they appeared incarnate in human life, they really were the descendants of those beings ensconced in the moon. The life of the bodhisattvas really flowed in union with the beings of the cosmic moon citadel. Therein lay the sources of their power. There lay the sources of their thoughts. And they, then, became the leaders of men, enabling the latter, through what they had taught them on earth, to make the transition, giving men the strength, after having reached the end of the moon region, to pass over to the region of the sun. In the following lecture, we shall see how, in the course of man's evolution on earth, this has now become impossible, and how one of the sun beings, the Christ himself, had to descend and go through the mystery of Golgotha, that through his Christ teaching, through the teaching given on earth, concerning the mystery of Golgotha, man might gain the full force necessary to enable him to accomplish the transition from the soul world to the spirit land, from the moon region to that of the sun. In older times of the earth's evolution, that which came from the moon region was inwardly connected with the earth, and it actually fostered and cared for the spiritual life on the earth. Now, instead of a direct or indirect influence from the moon, such as worked in the beings of the bodhisattvas, there descended to earth and intervened in its evolution when the times were finished, after the completion of the first third of the fourth post-Atlantean epochs, the influence of the mystery of Golgotha, the influence of the Christ surrounded by the 12 different bodhisattvas, as indicated. And this was also an actual fact, in the Christ surrounded by the 12 apostles. Thus the Christ, who, incarnated in the body of Jesus, is now the force coming from the sun existence, which has united itself with the earth. Just as we must now look up at the moon, not simply staring at it with a materialistic mind, but trying to understand it, regarding it as an assembly of spiritual beings, representing for the earth the past of cosmic evolution, so too must we look up at the sun, as the assembly of those beings who represent the future of earthly evolution, of whom now at the present time Christ is the great ambassador, who has gone through the mystery of Golgotha. Thereby, through what men on earth absorb through their relation to that mystery, their entrance into the spirit land, which means into the land of the spiritual sun, has become possible, and they are now able in the Mars region to absorb the Mars organization, in the region of Jupiter to acquire the Jupiter organs, and in the Saturn region the Saturn organs. And this in three different cycles, which take much longer to travel round than did the cycle of the moon. but this too is dependent on the evolution of the cosmos. And the complete fulfillment of what I have now described will only be possible to man in the future. In our present epoch, it is only possible through the working of the cosmic forces for man to circle fully through the Mars region, so that after death he can only complete the Mars circuit, but cannot yet enter completely into the Jupiter region. He can only contact it. Only in the course of future Earth lives will he be able, between death and a new birth, fully to enter the region of Jupiter, and he can only enter that of Saturn at a still later epoch. Now, although man cannot yet enter the Jupiter region, he can even now, between his death and rebirth, receive somewhat of those forces of Jupiter and Saturn. For that purpose there are, scattered between Mars and Jupiter, the multitudinous planetoids, the outer existence of which are constantly being discovered by astronomers, but which are really the spiritual region through which man has to pass after death, because he cannot yet attain to Jupiter. The peculiar feature of these planetoids is that their spiritual beings are, so to speak, colonies from Jupiter and Saturn. Beings from Jupiter and from Saturn have gone back to the planetoids. Before man is ripe for Earth existence, he encounters in the regions of the planetoids, strewn over our universe, that which is for the present a sort of substitute, until such times as he can really enter the region of Jupiter and Saturn. Thus at the present time, a man, after having passed through death and rebirth, is born into an age when he has acquired the Mars organs, and of the Jupiter and Saturn forces, he has absorbed those colonized in the region of the planetoids. With the after effects of Mars, of which we have more to hear, he enters the new Earth life. Tomorrow's lecture will further describe life between death and rebirth in relation to the world of the stars. The end of Lecture 10.